This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. With the rapid climb to the top of the New York Times bestseller list in 2018 of his book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence, author and journalist Michael Pollan managed to crack open a door that had been slammed shut on psychedelic drugs in the 1970s as part of the culture wars that were raging in the nation at that time. In the 2 years since the book's publication, several municipalities have taken steps to decriminalize the class of drugs that in multiple studies have been shown not only to be safe, but beneficial in treating a wide range of conditions, from treating addiction to reducing the anxiety of facing mortality. After the recent first arrest in Jefferson County for possession of psychedelic mushrooms in more than 20 years, a local group calling itself the Port Townsend Psychedelic Society is calling for the city and county to join the decriminalization movement by adopting a resolution defunding the pursuit or prosecution of such cases. Today on The Compass, we talk with one of the co-founders of the group, Aaron Redding. So now, let's go inside The Compass. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the Port Townsend Psychedelic Society and how old it is and why you started it?
So the Port Townsend Psychedelic Society started in response to Decriminalize Nature Oakland passing a resolution there, as well as Denver, Colorado, doing it by ballot. And I was interested because one of my graduate school colleagues was involved in the Oakland Decriminalize Nature movement. So I was starting to work on that here in contact with them. And then there was another woman, Rebecca Ramsey, who also was inspired by what happened in Oakland. And she, before I even met her, had already started the Port Townsend Psychedelic Society and had just started making a website and was working on introducing the resolution to the Jefferson County Board of Health. So we were both in contact with Oakland, and Oakland connected the two of us. And so we began working together under the umbrella of the Port Townsend Psychedelic Society. And we've been working on it ever since. And right now our main focus is on decriminalizing entheogens. I think the Port Townsend Psychedelic Society is also broader in that we want to provide education, support, safe contexts and ways to use entheogens responsibly. We want to provide education to schools. There's a lot of different things that we want to accomplish. And we also include synthetic psychedelics in our education, even though we're not working to decriminalize those right now.
Oh, you're not? So let's actually start off with that word entheogens, which I think for a lot of people is going to be a new word.
An entheogen means it's something that generates the divine within. That's the etymology of the word and the reason it's used to describe some psychedelics. And right now, in the context of decriminalization, it's being used to refer to natural psychedelics like cacti containing mescaline, psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca, iboga, plants and fungi that aren't processed.
I see. And so why have you chosen only to lobby for legalization of natural psychedelics as opposed to like LSD, for example?
Well, first, I just want to clarify that we're not working towards legalization. We're working towards decriminalization.
Okay. That's an important distinction.
It is, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And it's not that we're against, we'll get back to that. But coming back to your original question, things like LSD and MDMA and synthesized DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, things like that, oftentimes have purity issues, and we don't feel like we are ready to provide the labs, the testing, different things to fully help with safe use of those substances. And it's not that we don't also want to see them decriminalized, but I think it's less basic than access to natural plants and fungi that have been used traditionally by many other cultures way before we started working with them. So that's what we're focusing on. That's where we feel like we can be most successful. That's where we feel we can provide safety. People have access to the plants and fungi that you're not going to have issues with quality of the substance or purity. So that's what we're starting with. I think with LSD and MDMA, it may actually make more sense for them to be regulated in some way. We don't want to see that sort of regulation with natural psychedelics. We feel people have the basic right to access them and use them. We want to provide education, but we want to empower people to make their own decisions about how they use them. With LSD and MDMA and things like that, I think there are real safety issues that we don't encounter with natural psychedelics.
Safety. Now with the natural psychedelics, though, there have already been court cases that establish the right for their religious use.
That is true. Yeah, the Santo Daime Church has permission. The UDV has permission. The Native American Church has permission. And there's some other ones, too. And that's a great start. But we don't feel that people should have to go into these traditional religious structures in order to access these dimensions within themselves. We believe people should have the right to have access to these plants, to go in nature and take them, or to take them with friends and community. And many people, you know, have histories with different religious structures that aren't positive. It may not feel safe, or it might not be the right setting for some people to be in a religious space. And also a lot of these churches are still pretty underground, and a lot of people don't have access to them.
So how long have you been working on? So when did Oakland decriminalize?
I think it was June of 2019. It may have been a little bit earlier, but it was in that time period.
So not long ago, really. I mean, in the general scale of things. And what was your background that led you to feel, okay, I'm going to do this for Port Townsend?
Right. well, that's a complex question. I've been working and studying psychedelics, entheogens, since 2003 when I was an undergrad at UW in philosophy, and was very not inspired by the philosophy program. It was very analytical, and I was looking for philosophy as a way of life, not argumentation. And I had some friends give me some books on psychedelics, which I was very not open to. I was a product of the DARE program, and I was like, I'm just happy on life. Why would I need to ever take any drugs? And so I read these books, and pretty soon after reading them, I felt very hypocritical. And like, here I am studying reality, and here's this easy way to view it from a different perspective. And I'd been closed off to that. So I spent a year getting rid of all the propaganda in my head and preparing myself to do a journey, and completely changed my life, blew me away. And after even my first experience, I just could not understand why these plants weren't an integral part of our culture, part of philosophy programs, part of scientific studies, part of psychology. And so I started reading and studying them a lot more in depth. I went to the Albert Hofmann's birthday in Switzerland when they had a conference there in 2006. And at the time, there weren't a lot of conferences. Like, they weren't happening in the U.S. So I had to go to Europe to go to one. And then I went to a graduate school program where Stan Grof, who was a psychiatrist who worked with LSD and other psychedelics when they were legal, very successfully for many years, and wrote many books on it. And so I went to a pretty much at the time, the only graduate program that was really supportive of doing psychedelic research. And it was a philosophy program. So I was in that, and I got my master's in that program in 2009. And then I went into the PhD program and was writing a dissertation on psychedelics, philosophy, ethics, and ecology, and worked on that for too many years. And I actually just left the program the last year, not finishing my dissertation, mostly because my attention just has moved elsewhere outside of academia. And I'm much more interested in working in creating supportive structures, working in community, I'm much more interested in working at the local level with people more actively than writing a dissertation by myself on my computer. So when this came up, it was an opportunity to take all this energy and love and passion I have for these plants and do something relevant with my community.
So can you talk a little bit more about that sort of life-changing experience you had? I mean, what did you do specifically, and how did it change your life?
Yeah, so I took psilocybin mushrooms with a close friend of mine, and we were on the shores of Banks Lake in Eastern Washington, and we both had our dogs with us, and we took the medicine. This huge spider crawls up right next to me. It was there for an entirety of my journey, the biggest spider I've seen in my entire life. And I was pretty terrified of spiders. So that was an interesting part of the experience. But I closed my eyes, and as the mushrooms started to work, well, A, my whole relationship with the world around me changed, like what I paid attention to, what I noticed, what I was capable of seeing aesthetically, seeing in detail and things around me, like watching ants crawl around and being tuned into them in a way, like I never could have paid that much attention to a pair of ants crawling around on a rock. Like the detail, yeah, just my capacity to pay attention and my capacity to be aware of things I had never noticed before, to experience the world in a totally different way than I had prior to that experience. So that was like the external world. And then when I closed my eyes, I mean, just vision after vision after vision, understanding, like exploring different philosophical systems, exploring different religions, exploring my own psychology, just realizing that there's this vast universe within myself that I had no idea was there. And my whole life, I had thought these were just like, you know, drugs that people escape from life with. And in that moment, I realized that they were the most profound philosophy teacher I had ever had. And I learned more in 6 hours than I had learned in my entire philosophical education. And I was very befuddled and perplexed as to why they were not part of our culture.
Was the friend with you an experienced guide, or was it just a friend who was experimenting alongside you?
Just a friend experimenting alongside me. Yeah, it was her first time as well. Or maybe second time, but first time it had been like a profound experience.
I see. A couple of years ago, I read Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, which was a really eye-opening book for me. And it, I mean, one of the things that he comes down pretty strongly in favor of, though, is people not just doing what you did and experimenting, but actually at least initially having a guide, because as you say, the experience can be an extremely powerful one, and sometimes an experience that goes like sideways or worse. And I mean, I came of age in the 1970s when there was a lot of experimentation with psychedelics. And I personally have some friends who had some very scary experiences. And of course, society at large has tended to view these drugs as dangerous.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different aspects in responding to that question. I also would recommend people not take them with another friend who's also engaging in that experience. I do think that a trusted friend who is willing to hold space and has some experience with these medicines could be a good person to work with. And I think I was pretty lucky in that I felt very safe. I felt very held by the natural world. So I felt like I was in a very safe space, and having a friend with me that I had known since I was in second grade also created a sense of safety for me. And I also had my dog with me. So for me, that was enough to create a safe structure for me to have a really positive experience. You know, I think people take them at parties, at concerts, places like that, I think are much less likely to have a positive outcome. But there are also many people who do have experience with these medicines who I think can successfully use them more recreationally and oftentimes have positive outcomes. But I also recommend that people, you know, go to an actual ceremony, work with a therapist. A lot of the things that I've seen in being in psychedelic communities are people who, yeah, either have a really hard experience and they don't have people to support them, A, through the experience, and then B, to make sense of the experience afterwards and learn and grow from it rather than being traumatized by it. I have also seen a lot of people who have really profound positive experiences, but then don't know how to integrate them into their daily lives. And so it's not like these are magical pills or anything. They teach us and they reveal things to ourselves, but then we still have to do the work to integrate the lessons. And, you know, that can be, you know, how we are in relationship with people in our lives, what foods we eat, how we are of service to our communities. I feel like there's two layers, main layers I'm working at. One layer is the level of decriminalization. So in that conversation, it's more focusing on how these substances, even though you can have a really intense experience, there doesn't tend to be long-term negative impact, especially if you have a therapist to help you glean the lessons from a hard experience. And they're also very physiologically safe, way safer than alcohol or nicotine or things that actually do impact our bodies really negatively. And I think that the overall benefit of entheogens goes way beyond any negative impact we might see from people having difficult experiences. I also think that the way to work with difficult experiences or to prevent them from happening is education, like educating people at a young age how to use them responsibly. I don't think that people who are under the age of 18 should be using them. I think they probably will anyways, and I think it's better that we teach them how to have a safe experience rather than only teaching abstinence. But I also want to share real information with young people about why it makes sense to develop your brain and your ego first before you deconstruct it.
There is actually an impressive list of benefits that in your proposed resolution that you've put before the city council and the county commissioners, ranging from helping people get over addictions to addressing depression. And I don't know whether it was in here or in the press release, talking about actually like reversing recidivism. And I'd love to hear something about the basis for some of those claims.
Yeah, so there's a lot of evidence and a lot of studies that have separately looked at all those different claims. The recidivism one is probably the least researched, but there have been studies done where they looked at like about 25,000 people who had substance abuse issues and also criminal histories and were under community parole supervision. And they found that people who use psychedelics had a much better record of not going back to jail, not breaking parole, not violating any of the rules they were supposed to be following while they were under supervision. So that's one of the studies. There's also a group in Brazil that is taking prisoners and having them go to ayahuasca ceremonies and then working with them. We haven't really seen the results from that yet. I think it's been going on for about 6 years. And I've heard stories about how well it's going, but I don't think they've done any scientific follow-ups yet. And then there's another study that looks at intimate partner violence and found that people who work with psychedelics are much less likely to re-engage in domestic violence. For me, what is more evidence is having been in ceremonies with people who do have criminal records and have experiences of actually feeling the impact of their actions on the people that they were violent towards and reliving those experiences and really coming to terms with their actions and then asking for forgiveness and just seeing like a full transformation of people who were very hardened and had a lot of self-hatred and who were able to, yeah, just really come to terms with what they did and feel the impact of it and find ways to forgive themselves, to ask for forgiveness, and to move forward and be better people and citizens.
One of the most interesting things to me, reading Michael Pollan's book and then also watching the film Fantastic Fungi, which is something that I highly recommend to everybody, was the very beneficial effects that a lot of people who are going through end of life have experienced using the drugs. And I don't expect that you've gone through end of life yourself, and so maybe you can't talk about that personally, but maybe you have something to say about it.
Yeah, I know people that have been in those situations who have worked these medicines very profoundly. They help with anxiety, and I think the reason they help with anxiety is they give people a perspective of themselves beyond their like their embodied personality. And so it allows them to, in some sense, let go of their attachments to the physical world and feel more at peace with passing, whatever that means to them. Yeah, it's very beautiful, profound work, and is another example of something that I think should be made available to those who are in need of that, either in a therapeutic setting or with a beloved partner who can hold a safe space.
So let's move back to the local and mundane. You have presented this proposal for a resolution to be adopted by the city council. When did you first present this, and where does it stand?
So we first presented in August of 2019, and we also started at that time meeting individually with a lot of different people from the city council, from the county commissioners, with the police chief, with the police navigator, just with different people in town that we felt were relevant to what we were asking for, and also the Board of Health and Dr. Tom Locke. So we had a lot of conversations with a lot of people as well as presenting in the meetings themselves. And we didn't really receive any resistance in terms of agreeing with what we were presenting and asking for, but what we did receive was a pushback in terms of making decriminalization official, because there hadn't been a charge in Jefferson County for over 20 years. So they felt like it just wasn't worth taking the time and the money to make the change at a local level. And I think there was also a little bit of pushback from the former chief of police. He, I think, very much resonated with the resolution, but I think he felt that it would put police officers in an awkward position to be making an oath to the state to enforce laws and then being asked by a local department to not enforce certain laws. And I don't think, when we talked to him, we didn't have as good of an understanding about how decriminalization worked. And now we have a much better understanding that it happens through funding. So it actually doesn't put the officers in a double bind. There just isn't money to process the tickets if they did write a ticket, and there isn't money to pay them even to write those tickets. So it's not about breaking an oath, it's about taking away the funding. So now that there has been an arrest, which is what triggered us starting again, we had been working pretty consistently on trying to continue to meet with officials until COVID hit. And then it felt like the same people we were talking to were the ones that were having to deal with COVID. And so it felt respectful to give them some breathing room to focus on that for a while. And so we really just completely took a break. And then were contacted about the arrest that happened in November of Annie Barton. And that was, you know, again, the first arrest and charge that had been filed in 20 years. So they had told us, you know, this isn't a big deal. We haven't had any arrests. If you have an arrest, well, then come back and talk to us. So there was an arrest. And so now we're back mobilizing and educating and sending in public comments and letters and, yeah, back in communication with the commissioners and the city council.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about the case? Yeah, I mean, like, how did it come about that she was arrested? And she had psilocybin, right?
So she was pulled over on the side of the road. She was picking up a friend of hers who worked at a local business. And it was, you know, late in the evening and kind of, you know, not typical place to be parked. So a police officer from Port Townsend pulled over and walked up to her car, knocked on the window, and was asking her questions about why she was there. And she was explaining that she was picking her friend up, and she offered to show the police officer her ID. And so he said, yeah, sure, if you want to show it to me, that'd be great. And so she's rumbling through her purse, trying to find her ID, and ends up pulling out a bag of psilocybin mushrooms and drops it on the floor. And the police officer immediately is like, what were those? Are those brown tops? Is that psilocybin mushrooms? Hand me that bag. And so she hands him the bag and he goes, are these psilocybin mushrooms? And at first she's like, no, I don't know. My friend gave them to me. I'm not really sure. And then she's like, yeah, they probably are. And then he, you know, has her step out and immediately handcuffs her and arrests her and puts her in the back of his car. So that was how she was arrested. Later on in the arrest, her friend shows up and there are some, I don't want to say comical, but I watched the police body cam, and the officer who did the arresting, he wasn't really sure. He didn't really know much about psilocybin. And at one point he went back to his car and looks up psilocybin and it's like, oh, it's Schedule 1, high potential for abuse. And then gets out and it's like, did you guys know that psilocybin is Schedule 1? It's a high potential for abuse. So for us, and then the other thing he said was, you know, to Annie's friend is, you know, I had my body cam video on, and if you show me something like that in front of a body cam video, then I have to arrest you. So those two statements for us as an organization were exactly what we needed to move forward with decriminalization. And it's not about demonizing the individual officer. It's about, like, the system says, right, that these Schedule 1, that they're a high potential for abuse. So that's one of the problems. And then the other point is that because the system says these have a high potential for abuse, then if a police officer sees something on their video cam, they feel obligated right now to make an arrest. So that's why we feel decriminalization is so important. And then later on in the arrest, on Annie's keychain, they found some OxyContin. And this is 100% half an hour after she's already been arrested. So the arrest was not for the OxyContin, but I think some of the press right now is reporting on this, making it sound like she was arrested for the OxyContin and for the mushrooms, but they were completely, that was secondary.
No charges were added for the OxyContin?
the charge was added, but that's why she was arrested in the first place. It was added on as a secondary charge. But it is part of the reason that James Kennedy, the prosecuting attorney, is refusing to drop the psilocybin charge. He agrees that psilocybin is very low priority, that, you know, it doesn't cause problems, that people aren't out, you know, being violent on psilocybin. That's not something that happens. But he feels like he wants to keep that charge to, if Annie has an opiate addiction, he wants to make sure that she gets to drug treatment. And so he's committed to keeping the charge for psilocybin, even though psilocybin is non-addictive and actually helps with addiction. He wants to keep that charge as like an additional thing to get her to treatment, which I think that if he wants her in treatment for opiate addictions, he should use the charge for opiate possession, psilocybin doesn't relate to that. So we're definitely in disagreement there, but that's where things currently lie with that case.
Yeah, on the subject of decriminalization of drugs, I mean, you know, what is your position on that? I think I told you yesterday that I did a story a couple of weeks ago about Oregon's decriminalization of all drugs, you know, which is not to decriminalize like dealing in drugs and so on and so forth, but just actual possession and ingestion is no longer a crime in Oregon. What do you feel about that?
We definitely also support the decriminalization of all substances. I think that addiction is a health issue. I think it's also a community social issue. I don't think people should be criminalized for addiction. I think they should be able to access help for addiction. Psychedelics being one of those very effective ways of working successfully with addiction. I also want to keep entheogens separate from that because I don't think that they should be, they're not a harmful drug in the first place. So they shouldn't be lumped in with other decriminalized substances like heroin or meth or, you know, prescription meds. I think they should not be in that category of addictive substances. But I do also think that addiction in general should be decriminalized.
I mean, the fact is at the moment, if you go out mushroom hunting and you gather up a bunch of mushrooms and actually sweep in a bunch of psilocybins and fry them up for dinner, you've committed a crime, right?
You've committed a felony.
Yeah. A felony, right.
And if you get convicted of a felony, you can't get financial aid. It's very hard to get a job. It's hard to get housing and go to jail. It's very disproportional to the action.
With Port Townsend Psychedelic Society co-founder Aaron Redding, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.